Studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, President Donald Trump publicly scolded one of his top government health officials, contradicting him on the issue of a COVID-19 vaccine and the importance of wearing masks. CDC Director Robert Redfield, in a Senate hearing on Wednesday, had said that enough vaccines for the public would likely not be available until the third quarter of 2021. And that until then, masks were the most effective and important tool at keeping the virus at bay. This is how the New York Times described what happened Thursday. Quote, in a remarkable display even for him, Mr. Trump publicly slapped down Mr. Redfield during remarks to reporters.
But when I called up Robert today, I said to him, what's with the mask? He said, I think I answered that question incorrectly. I think maybe he misunderstood it. I mean, you know, you have two questions. Maybe he misunderstood both of them. But the answer to the one is it's going to be a much faster distribution than he said. Maybe he's not aware of the distribution process. It's not really his thing as much as it would be, let's say, mine. But the distribution is going to be much faster. As far as the mask is concerned, I hope that the vaccine is going to be a lot more beneficial than the masks, because people have used the masks. As far as the mask is concerned, he made a mistake.
Trump also played down the death toll, implying that 200,000 dead Americans wasn't so bad, and that virus deaths were high in so-called blue states, not red.
This was right at the beginning. This was our prediction, that if we do a really good job, we'll be at about 100,000 to 240,000 deaths. And we're below that substantially, and that's despite the fact that the blue states had tremendous death rates. If you take the blue states out, we're at a level that I don't think anybody in the world would be at. We're really at a very low level. But
the Washington Post pointed out that more recent virus infections and deaths are heavily tilted toward red states. Trump also claimed that, quote, our biggest threat to this election is governors from opposing parties controlling ballots, millions of ballots. He added, to me, that's a much bigger threat than foreign countries, because much of the stuff coming out about foreign countries turned out to be untrue. But Trump's own FBI director, Christopher Wray, testified to Congress on Thursday about the seriousness of Russian-led efforts to undermine the election. Wray confirmed the various ways in which Russia has acted.
Social media, use of proxies, state media, online journals, etc., an effort to both sow divisiveness and discord, and I think the intelligence community has assessed this publicly, to denigrate Vice President Biden and what the Russians see as kind of an anti-Russian establishment.
That's FBI Director Christopher Wray testifying to Congress on Thursday. Mr. Wray also confirmed during the hearing that white supremacists make up the largest share of racially motivated terrorists in the United States.
Within the domestic terrorism bucket category as a whole, racially motivated violent extremism is, I think, the biggest bucket within that larger group. And within the racially motivated violent extremist bucket, people ascribing to some kind of white supremacist type ideology is certainly the biggest chunk of that.
Okay. That's FBI Director Christopher Wray. Thousands of pages of internal documents from the U.S. Postal Service were obtained through the Freedom of Information Act this week and paint a disturbing picture of the number of ways in which the Trump administration has worked to undermine the agency's effectiveness. The documents and correspondence were largely dated from March and April of this year. And the Washington Post, which was able to access them, summarized that they, quote, depict an agency in distress as its deteriorating finances collided with a public health emergency and a looming election that would be heavily reliant on absentee ballots. Highlighting a potentially new conflict of interest, the documents also revealed that the Postal Service had relied on the counsel of a Republican lawyer named Stefan Passantino, who is now, quote, part of a new pro-Trump legal coalition preparing for the possibility of a contested election. There's also information about an ambitious plan that the Postal Service was considering to mail 5 face coverings per American to every household in the country to help prevent the spread of the coronavirus. That plan, of course, never transpired. Meanwhile, the National Postal Mail Handlers Union denounced Trump's crippling of the USPS and endorsed Joe Biden for president. Trump and his team is coming under fire for claiming that the president has a health care plan, something that he's been promising for years but has yet to reveal. In practice, the White House has legally attacked the entirety of the Affordable Care Act while verbally claiming to support aspects of it and offering rhetoric about a new plan. But a new plan has yet to materialize less than 2 months before the election. Here is White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany responding to a reporter's question, followed by Trump's campaign communications director, Tim Murtaugh, in a CNN interview with Aaron Burnett.
I'm not going to give you a readout of what our health care plan looks like and who's working on it. If you want to know, come work here at the White House.
80 million people.
But
that
Tim,
is not the direction
again,
Americans
want to go. Again, I just point out
that
you may be correct about that, but at least Joe Biden has a plan out there. I mean, I'm just saying President Trump has promised one for 3 years. If there was a plan, we would have seen it by now. I mean, pretty obvious, right?
I think we've gone over this question a couple times now, and I'm not going to get a...
That's Trump's campaign communications director, Tim Murtaugh, unable to reveal any details about the president's new health care plan that he has touted for years. Attorney General William Barr is pushing aggressively for protesters from the Black Lives Matter movement to be charged with sedition in a move denounced by civil libertarians. Among those that Barr is targeting for charges is Jenny Durkan, the mayor of Seattle, for apparently allowing protesters to take over several city blocks for some months earlier this year. Durkan denounced the reports, saying on Twitter, the DOJ cannot become a political weapon operated at the behest of the president to target those who have spoken out against his actions. That is an act of tyranny, not of democracy. Ironically, Barr accused his own Justice Department staff of political interference, which is apparently how he views prosecutions of President Trump's associates and friends. In a speech to a conservative college, Barr claimed, under the law, all prosecutorial power is invested in the Attorney General. Throwing his own staff under the bus, Barr also said, letting the most junior members set the agenda might be a good philosophy for a Montessori preschool, but it is no way to run a federal agency. During the same speech, Barr claimed that coronavirus lockdowns were the, quote, greatest intrusion on civil liberties in American history since slavery. Barr's statements come at a time when a whistleblower revealed that federal law enforcement agents had begun to stockpile ammunition and non-lethal weapons such as a heat ray and high audio devices before violently clearing away Lafayette Square in Washington, D.C. for President Trump's now notorious church front photo op. In sworn testimony that D.C. National Guard Major Adam D. DeMarco shared with the Washington Post, DeMarco apparently, quote, told lawmakers that defense officials were searching for crowd control technology deemed too unpredictable to use in war zones and had authorized the transfer of about 7,000 rounds of ammunition to the D.C. Armory. Members of Congress and the Department of Homeland Security are investigating recently revealed claims by a whistleblower that numerous female immigrant detainees at a privately run facility had been sterilized without their consent. The whistleblower's claims have been corroborated by several women's own testimonies about the hysterectomies that were conducted on them. Immigrant rights activists were able to successfully halt the deportation of one woman who had come forward about her experience. And that does it for our news headlines. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Among the impacts of the recent Postal Service upheaval is the right to vote of jailed Americans. At any given time, there are hundreds of thousands of Americans held in pre-trial detention in county jails across the country. And during election season, those Americans are still eligible to vote. Now, ahead of an election where the incumbent has already promised to contest results he does not like, one group in Houston, Texas, is working to ensure that in spite of Postal Service cutbacks, jailed inmates know their rights and have access to the ballot. My guest is Durrell Douglas, founder and president of Houston Justice. Welcome to the program, Durrell.
Thank you for having me.
So I mentioned hundreds of thousands, but how do we, you know, what is the number in general? These are county jails across the country where people who are arrested, may not be out on bail, are held until they are at trial. And we know in this country we're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. And therefore, all of the rights that we have in terms of the right to vote should be preserved. So how big is this population?
According to the Sentencing Project's latest report, they took a snapshot of 2017, and there were over 740,000 people in county jails across the United States, roughly 400,000 of them likely eligible to vote because they're in pretrial detention.
And so about half of them eligible to vote. What about the other half?
You have another half that's either on paper, maybe they're on probation or parole in addition to their latest charge. But in places like Harris County or Dallas County in Texas, Los Angeles County and Cook County in Chicago, you have upwards of 75% of those who happen to be behind bars that are merely there for pretrial detention, not because they've been sentenced, not because they're there because of a felony, and not being held before they move on to prison.
And of course, because our criminal justice system, our policing, we know has been documented over and over again to basically be racially biased, I imagine that this population is disproportionately Black and brown.
Overwhelmingly Black and brown. Oftentimes, I actually used to work for the Texas prison system for 5 years, and going to work every day was very similar to walking up and down the streets in the neighborhood that I grew up in or going to a family reunion. And when you really look at the layers of the system and you really look at, the stories that I would hear while working at the prison, meeting the families and hearing the stories of the people who are incarcerated, you see that this is kind of by design. And very similar to the disproportionality that exists in jails, it's the same way in prison, and it's something that we definitely need to address.
So I imagine that voting by mail is one of the main ways in which jailed inmates who are eligible to vote can cast their ballots. I mean, don't counties arrange for ballot access inside jails?
Not actually. In a lot of the counties, they're actually using the United States Postal Service. And one note that's very interesting that everybody should take note of, when you're looking at the communication between the U.S. Department of Mail, the U.S. Postal Service, that's just one part of this equation. When the piece of mail actually gets to a jail or to a prison unit, there's an entirely different a process that can add up to a week or more of additional time that it takes for someone who happens to be incarcerated to get their mail, or before it actually reaches the point where it can go out. So when you look at something as important as a voting, where the deadlines are concrete, it can have a huge impact on their franchise.
In past elections, would it be fair to say that most jailed inmates are disenfranchised, or, you know, because these postal service attacks have been more recent, that they have had better access to the ballot?
I think with everything that's going on with the Postal Service, I think it adds even more of a hurdle to jump over. But most of the counties that we're talking to, the overwhelming majority of them do not have a mechanism in place to allow those who are incarcerated to vote. You have to think, you can end up in jail over a traffic ticket that you just didn't pay or because you couldn't afford it, that turned into a warrant, and now you have people who are behind bars and unable to vote.
And of course, this also ensures that the people who are jailed are disproportionately low income. So let's talk about how the process could work. I imagine that there's people who are in jail who are registered to vote, but maybe registered to their home address, and also people who just have not been registered to vote, right?
Absolutely. So the way we do it in Harris County, we have a county clerk, County Clerk Chris Hollins.
And this is Harris County, Texas, where you reside. Yeah. So the Harris County Jail is where you've brought this project.
Absolutely. And our county sheriff, Ed Gonzalez, is very open to doing whatever's necessary in order for those who are incarcerated in order to get the ballot. But it didn't start that way, right? When we started, there wasn't a mechanism. And the way it works in Harris County, we actually take volunteers behind bars to do this voter registration. So you have citizens that are registering the same way they would in the parking lot of a Walmart or a Target, and they're also given the opportunity to apply for a ballot by mail or an absentee ballot. Some counties call it different things in different places.
Do you find that a lot of folks don't even know that they have the right to vote while they're in jail?
Absolutely. The overwhelming majority of people, when they find out that we're there to register them to vote, it's a kind of shocking thing. Mm-hmm. We've actually teamed up with Bun B and Trey, rapper Trey the Truth, and we did these PSAs that we have running on social media and actually inside the jail to tell people, hey, just because you happen to be incarcerated doesn't mean that you've lost your right to vote, and tell them the steps that they need to take in order to make sure that that happens.
What level of eagerness is there that you've seen for people to exercise their right to vote?
We've been doing this since 2018, and I will say this year, there's been an extreme uptick in enthusiasm and charisma from those behind bars ready to vote. We actually, not only do we do voter registration, we also do, we bring applications for the ballot by mail, the absentee ballot. And this year, in 2018, for the runoff, our primary runoff, we had more requests than we've had in any of the elections leading up to this. So
this is the Texas primary?
The Texas primary in March. So the runoff, not the actual primary itself, the runoff.
Ah, okay. Which,
exactly. And so, and here recently, as we've gone into the Harris County Jail, there's been a huge uptick in people making those requests, and people are on the edge of their seats to vote, even though they happen to be behind bars right now.
So what are the ways in which the Postal Service upheavals could impact the right to vote for jailed inmates? You mentioned that you have to add an extra week in there, and you know, but things are rapidly changing because of the pandemic. Some states have changed the start time for voting. There's a lot of early voting going on. Some states are doing, you know, sending everybody a ballot by mail, regardless of whether they request one. So it's complicated depending upon where you live, state by state, even county by county, it can be difficult. So what are your fears about how Postal Service upheavals could disenfranchise inmates?
Even when the everyday American who's not behind bars has to fill out an absentee ballot, it's not a very cut and dry simple thing. It's very complicated, and there are multiple parts on that application, no matter what state or what county you're in, that make it sort of a thing that you're not sure of. So when you add to the fact that someone behind bars can't pick up the phone and call their county to make sure that something was received, or they can't call and ask a question really quickly about a section on that document, it really adds to the turnaround time. And so with these deadlines being absolutely concrete and unable to be changed, I'm pretty sure we're going to run into a system, unfortunately, where those who are behind bars will fill out these applications to the best of their ability. They'll mess up one part or one section. It'll get kicked back to them, but they won't receive it in time to make those corrections and turn them in, or they'll be kicked back and they won't get a response and they won't get their ballot in time to vote. So that's something that we're really being forward about, and we're really doing the extra work to make sure that those things happen.
And we know that there are so many cases, like here in the state of California, where election staffers, poll workers might just throw out hundreds or thousands of ballots because the signature didn't match. And of course, they're not handwriting analysis experts. And so imagine that that is also a problem for jailed inmates who don't have any other choice other than to use the Postal Service to mail in their ballot.
Absolutely. And then you run into situations where when in a place like Chicago, Cook County, or in Harris County Jail has 10,000 people, you run into a situation where John Doe is getting his ballot, but there are four John Does on that at that jail.
Oh,
and so
wow,
that's
right.
A problem that you could potentially run into, and maybe the mail person decides to send it to the one that they think it is. It goes to him, it gets kicked back. Meanwhile, the real John Doe, who that was belonging to, is still thinking that it hasn't gotten to him because he's used to waiting longer for his mail to arrive.
Wow.
He finally reaches the point where he's sure that he hasn't received it, and he's trying to reach out, and it's too late because there's no way for him to vote.
Right. I mean, generally, for those among us who are not incarcerated, you wouldn't have two people by the same name necessarily at the same address. Why can't big jail systems like the ones you've cited simply bring in ballot machines into jails?
Absolutely. So that's something that we were actually talking about literally 1 week before quarantine hit. We were actually having conversations with the clerk's office, with the sheriff's office about what this might look like. Initially, one of the pushbacks was you can't have ballots, or you can't have a polling location that is that is exclusive. And if you have a polling location that's in a jail, it's at a place that the general public can't go. The example that the clerk gave at the time, it was Diane Troutman, the example she gave was if the country club were to have a polling location there, people would be in the streets. And I agree, I would definitely be in the street if the country club had a polling location that was exclusive to them. But there are creative ways that counties can make this happen. One of the ways that Harris County, Houston, Texas, is looking to do it is we know that often people who are in jail end up going back and forth to court. And there's usually some type of tunnel system that is accessed by those who are in jail and being escorted by your sheriffs or your sheriff's deputies to court and back, and that would be the perfect place to do it. So in places where there's not currently a polling location, that's one of the options that's been looked at, and it's definitely being looked at in Harris County. And we're doing all that we can to make sure that for the 2020 election, that's something that happens. Because you look at the numbers in states like Michigan, where the vote total was decided by a mere 10,000 votes amongst the millions who voted. You have 10,000 people in the jail in Harris County. So we want to make sure that every single ballot is counted, and everyone who's eligible to vote actually has that opportunity.
The example you cited about you can't have a ballot or voting machines in a country club seems quite disingenuous. I mean, people who go to a country club are there by choice. People who are in jail are not there by choice. They have no other option than to reside at the county jail, if you will. So that just seems a loophole. And I want to get to this issue of the reluctance of officials to ensure that incarcerated people, don't lose their right to vote. We know, for example, for years there's been efforts in states like Florida to allow felons the right to vote, because once you're convicted of a felony, in most states around the country, you lose your right to vote. In Florida, there was a ballot measure voters approved it. The Republican legislature has overturned it. It's gone to court. The court has sided with state officials, and it's just remarkable. Have you seen a similar reluctance to allow jailed inmates, whose right to vote is not in question, also see that pushback against allowing them to vote?
Absolutely. We've reached out to different counties in Texas. And one of the things that I found just astonishing, I was on the phone with an actual elected sheriff of a county that I will not mention because, who knows, but they're on the phone with an actual sheriff who said they're really short-staffed and they've cut out other programs like the Volunteer Bible Study Group. And he went down this list of elected programs and said he just doesn't have the capacity to make something like this work at his facility. And, my response was, it's the law. You can't make that decision.
It's not optional to give people the right to vote.
Absolutely. It's not art club. Like, this is some, you are an elected official, and you can't just say, we're not, you can't opt out. And so we're going to do all that we can to sort of identify where those situations are happening and make sure that something happens.
So outside of Harris County, what about nationwide? You mentioned Cook County Jail in Chicago, Men's Central Jail in Los Angeles, and of course there's jails all over the country where there's likely people who are, being disenfranchised unless there is an organization like yours or the Sentencing Project to help them through the process. Are there groups, and why should it be left to organizations like yours to do this work? You would imagine that this should be something that the counties in question take it upon themselves to ensure.
Absolutely. In a perfect world, our project wouldn't exist. In a perfect world, volunteers wouldn't be necessary to make sure that this happens. Next Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern, there's going to be a conversation online. It's going to be a Zoom webinar hosted by the Sentencing Project, where those who are on the ground, I know the League of Women Voters in Washington, D.C. is working on this. There are organizations in Michigan and Wisconsin and Arizona and in a lot of places where people are paying a whole lot of attention to polls right now, in order to make sure that we are looking at what best practices are. And we're sort of rolling into this election season as equipped as possible to make sure that as many people as possible are able to submit their ballot.
Do you find that family members of those who are jailed are eager to volunteer?
Absolutely. Not only family members of those that are incarcerated ready to volunteer, but I was on a panel yesterday hosted by the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority. And of the three panelists that were there, one guy randomly, and this just happened by happenstance, he asked me if I had ever worked on the central unit in Sugar Land. And I said, yes. He said he was on the unit when I was a sergeant. At the central unit in Sugar Land, Texas, and he's now on the battlefield doing this. So you have people who are formerly incarcerated, you have their family members, and you have advocates in the community that are very eager to make this happen.
And as you said earlier, the margins of votes can be razor thin. It's not just the presidential race. Of course, there are congressional races, Senate races, city council races, state legislature races, judicial races. There are so many races up and down the ballot, local ballots in particular, that and measures and propositions where just a few votes can make a difference. So how do people get involved if they are interested in helping out? You know, maybe they don't have a personal connection to someone who's incarcerated, or maybe themselves haven't been, but they just feel that this is an important issue because there's a lot of get out the vote efforts happening around the country right now. And given how eager this population is to vote, I imagine this is a wonderful opportunity for Get Out the Vote activists to register them.
Absolutely. I would say go to the sentencingproject.org, join their mailing list. A lot of groups are sort of resorting to this pen pal system in order to not only register and make sure that absentee ballots are happening, but we can't knock on doors in this COVID quarantine that we're in. And people who are incarcerated, you can't really call them or text them. So people are going old school and they're pulling out their pens and paper and they're hopping on their computers and they're writing letters to talk to those who are incarcerated about voting and making sure that if they do qualify, that they are able to vote, but also having the conversations about the issues that are often interesting to those who happen to be incarcerated.
And you mentioned, of course, because of the pandemic, things are different now. What are the, for those who do volunteer in person, I imagine that there's a lot of precautions being taken because people are scared of, and jails and prisons are not the most conducive to social distancing, and inmates are very vulnerable to the disease.
Absolutely. So in Harris County, we're following the CDC guidelines. Everyone is masked up, people are wearing gloves, and we're keeping that safe distance. It is a little awkward to stand in front of a dormitory and yell with your mask on, but if you enunciate, people can hear you. And so this is a very important race, and we're practicing social distancing. But we're going in and we're making it happen. And in counties across the United States, there are people just like what doing just like what we're doing in Harris County.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Jordal, for joining us today. Give out the website for Houston Justice.
HoustonJustice.org is the website for Houston Justice. Look forward to your listeners and viewers logging on.
And you had mentioned earlier the Sentencing Project. They're online at sentencingproject.org. We'll link to both websites from our site later today. Thank you so much, Darrell, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Darrell Douglas, founder and president of Houston Justice. We've been discussing efforts to register jailed voters and get them access to the ballot at election time. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The 2020 presidential election is bringing back memories of election night 2016, when the nation was preparing to usher in the first female president and instead got Donald Trump. Nearly 4 years of relentless repression, lies, constitutional insults, ethical violations, human rights abuses, and white supremacist resurgence has left us weary and wary. Polls show Democratic nominee Joe Biden with a healthy lead, but polls were misleading 4 years ago. Biden is not Trump, but neither is he Bernie Sanders. He is a continuation of neoliberal centrist Democratic Party policies. But the alternative is something that even many Republican Party members are now fearful of. Joining me to discuss what's at stake this November is Michael Denzel Smith, author of the New York Times bestseller Invisible Man, Got the Whole World Watching. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Harper's, The Nation, The Atlantic, and more. He's a fellow at Type Media Center. And his latest book is called Stakes is High, Life After the American Dream. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
It's been many years since we had you on our program, and so much has happened. What is remarkable about these past 4 years is that some of us have survived, but not all of us. There's been so much repression, as I mentioned, and people are really weary. Is that the reason why you wrote this book, to try to understand and make sense of what brought Trump into power and what we can expect in the next few months?
Well, the part of the reason for writing the book is that I understood exactly what brought Trump to power, but I was in denial at that time, like I think so many of us were. And so on election night, it was just realizing we're seeing American history play out as it always does. For all of the limitations of the Obama administration, I'll be the first one to critique everything about that administration and Barack Obama as a public figure, a politician, a public intellectual. It did represent for some people a sense of progress, right? Like there's something that happened that shifted in the country to allow the country to have 8 years of its first Black president. And for another part of the country, what that meant was, and these are particularly aggrieved white men, that the country was slipping away from them. They were no longer the center of American identity. And so they were fighting back, and they fought back in the form of Donald Trump. And everyone invested in everything that Donald Trump represents got on board with that. And so it's not so much that I needed to make sense of why it happened. I understood why it happened. I needed to make sense of why I, even as a critic of US empire, a critic of US capitalism, a critic of US racism, still fell into the trap of believing that this country could be on some linear sense of progress. Why did I feel that way? And really, it's to say that no matter where we sit, those of us who are a part of this country have bought in to some degree to the American narrative. And the American narrative just states that we are always progressing, that we are a beacon of democracy, and that we are the greatest nation on the face of the earth. And so even as a critic, even as someone who doesn't feel like they buy into all of those things and the things that fall under those types of ideas, I've bought into some degree, and I wanted to understand why that was, and then to challenge other people to see where they have been buying into that narrative so that we can divest from it, because that's the only way that we're going to break ourselves free of a cycle that produces Donald Trump's.
So do you think that this notion that America is the greatest democracy on the planet has, sort of created a sense of hubris collectively that in part made us vulnerable to what happened nearly 4 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the American identity is built on hubris. It's built on this, the idea that we're better than anything that has ever existed, anything that ever will exist, and that we must protect the borders of America, and I say that both physically and metaphorically, the borders of America and American identity, and that, you know, anything that's a threat to it must be eradicated. And so we buy into this, all of us, and I say that I place myself in that and make myself culpable, because I did, and as I write in the book, sort of like looked at New York City as this place that could foster all of the thing, all of the hopes and dreams that I had for myself. But New York City is the place where that created Donald Trump, like as a microcosm, right? Like New York City is the place where Trump's family was able to prosper in the ways that they did by exploiting people, by being slumlords. And that Donald Trump was able to create his ideology through New York media. It's the place that I live, and that I can go outside and I can see more police officers than trash cans on my block. It's to say that, you know, for everything that we tried to hold dear about what America represents in our imagination, none of it holds up to have the actual to reality. None of it does. And so we get this sense, because of the way of American history has been told, the way that American identity has been constructed, that we simply have to claim American and therefore we are better. And that hubris means that we don't listen to critique. We don't listen to the ways in which people are trying to push America, the U.S., to be better. We don't acknowledge those things in any real way unless they're couched in very soft language that reinforces the very idea of American exceptionalism. And then when those critiques are presented that way, people don't hear the critique. All they hear is the stuff about loving America.
Then this year, we've had, sort of broadly speaking, three huge dents in American hubris: the coronavirus pandemic and the way in which it's played out, where literally people outside the country feel sorry for us, massive racial injustice coming to a head, you know, the documentation being in our face, even though, of course, it has a very long history, and police repression and brutality, so embarrassing that the United Nations is calling for the country to deal with it, climate catastrophe on both coasts. These are huge reality checks for Americans, right?
They should be. They absolutely should be. I don't know how many, like, that's the thing that as I see these images of people marching so that they don't have to wear a mask. And I think to myself, you know, how is it that people are so invested in the idea of the individual to the point that they're not willing to put a piece of cloth over their face to protect their neighbor? You know, like the idea that they just don't believe that COVID exists, or that it's overblown.
And in fact, just to interrupt you for a second, Attorney General William Barr recently said that he thought COVID restrictions were the worst impact on civil liberties and civil rights since slavery.
Yes, yes. I mean, the idea that you can't go to a bar is the same as slavery, or similar, or just as could rise to that sort of level of degradation. I mean, it's ridiculous, but it's also the way in which we've constructed simply the idea that America can overcome everything. And so, you know, the fires are raging out there on the West Coast and making the air unbreathable. And this is going to continue happening. And there are people who are trying to act as if the fires themselves are a conspiracy, that this is somehow an agenda that's being put forth by people to take away their liberties. And I think people get hung up on the idea of what liberty and what freedom means. And it's always like this freedom to, the freedom to consume more, the freedom to live exactly the way that they have decided needs to be, is proper. And that doesn't pay attention to anyone else's needs or acknowledge anyone else's presence, that defines an other that needs to be eradicated, and not another that needs to be subjected to forms of violence that would be reprehensible if they were experienced by these people. It's just to say, you know, these should be wake-up calls, especially the stuff with regards to climate disaster, because we have so little time to address it. But somehow the American hubris persists, and we don't have much time. Like the title of the book is "Stakes Is High," because they're the highest that they've been. If we don't act now, we're talking about the very extinction of our species.
You dedicate your book, one of the people who dedicate your book to is Shirley Chisholm. And there was, of course, an era in America that elders remember that seemed very similarly existential when people were just fighting for the right to vote, fighting for the right to be treated equally, to be able to, you know, use a lunch counter the same as anybody else. Is there anything we can learn from that time that can apply now to this new reality? I mean, it's similar, but it's also very different.
It's very different. And I think, you know, in exploring the legacy of Shirley Chisholm, what I was trying to get us to confront is that, you know, through the course of American history and the telling of American history, there arise these figures that are real critics of American exceptionalism, real critics of the American identity, the things that make it up, but yet somehow they get subsumed into the fabric of that story as if their bravery is somehow uniquely American, but the obstacles they face were not. And so the question to be asking about Shirley Chisholm and her legacy is not to be celebrating that she was the first Black woman elected to Congress or the first Black woman to run for president on a major party ticket. The question is, why did it take so long for a Black woman to be able to do that? And why was she unable in 1972 to garner even 2% of the Democratic Party vote? What did she stand for that they're so afraid of? And you look at her actual record and you look at what she was fighting for as a member of Congress, and you say, now we can celebrate her or bring her up in a conversation with Barack Obama, Shirley Chisholm paving the way for Barack Obama to be able to run, paving the way for Hillary Clinton to be able to run, when their records don't match up. It's like the very first speech that Shirley Chisholm delivered on the House floor was an anti-Vietnam War speech that called into question America's commitment to using its resources to kill and maim us overseas while people starved here at home. These are things that are the actual part of her legacy. There are people here being eradicated, and another that needs to be subjected to forms of violence that would be reprehensible if they were experienced by these people. it's just to say, you know, these should be wake-up calls, especially the stuff with regards to climate disaster, because we have so little time to address it. But somehow the American hubris persists, and we don't have much time. Like, the title of the book is Stakes is High, because they're the highest that they've been. If we don't act now, we're talking about the very extinction of our species.
You dedicate your book, one of the people who dedicate your book to is Shirley Chisholm. And there was, of course, an era in America that elders remember that seemed very similarly existential, when people were just fighting for the right to vote, fighting for the right to be treated equally, to be able to, you know, use a lunch counter the same as anybody else. Is there anything we can learn from that time that can apply now to this new reality? I mean, it's similar, but it's also very different.
It's very different. And I think, you know, in exploring the legacy of Shirley Chisholm, what I was trying to get us to confront is that, you know, through the course of American history and the telling of American history, there arise these figures that are real critics of American exceptionalism, real critics of the American identity, the things that make it up, but yet somehow they get subsumed into the fabric of that story as if their bravery is somehow uniquely American, but the obstacles they face were not. And so the question to be asking about Shirley Chisholm and her legacy is not to be celebrating that she was the first Black woman elected to Congress or the first Black woman to run for president on a major party ticket. The question is, why did it take so long for a Black woman to be able to do that? And why was she unable in 1972 to garner even 2% of the Democratic Party vote? What did she stand for that they're so afraid of? And you look at her actual record and you look at what she was fighting for as a member of Congress, and you say, now we can celebrate her or bring her up in a conversation with Barack Obama, Shirley Chisholm paving the way for Barack Obama to be able to run, paving the way for Hillary Clinton to be able to run, when their records don't match up. It's like the very first speech that Shirley Chisholm delivered on the House floor was an anti-Vietnam War speech that called into question America's commitment to using its resources to kill and maim us overseas while people starved here at home. These are things that are the actual part of her legacy. And so I think what I want us to take away from this is that the legacies of these people that we continually invoke as some sort of, as part of the story of what makes America great, have often been people that have fiercely criticize the very nature of the American system, of our structures. And we can't continue to allow ourselves or allow these people to be used in such a way that reinforces that story as opposed to questions it.
And yet we are told, especially in the last few years, that any criticism of American, of what has happened to America is an affront, an insult to the flag, is a slap in the face of democracy and patriotism. And, you know, if you kneel down to protest racist violence by police, you're somehow insulting veterans. This is a very convenient way in which Trump and his backers seem to be able to silence their critics. And unfortunately, too many in the mainstream accept too much of it.
Yeah, and you bring up the NFL protest and where it started in the NFL and Colin Kaepernick kneeling during the national anthem and people's criticisms that he was disrespecting the flag, disrespecting the anthem, disrespecting the veterans, disrespecting our armed forces. The idea that those two things are synonymous, essentially, that the only way to fight for American freedom is through military aggression, speaks to just what we value, right? What we think of in terms of how that's constructed. American freedom, then, if it is tied directly to American imperialism through military efforts and through military violence means that what we're protecting ourselves from is the idea of outside invaders, anything that comes that's going to attack us, right? And so there's that construction, and then there's the idea that even if you look at American history and you say that you're going to celebrate the end of things like segregation, you're going to celebrate the end of slavery, you're going to celebrate people who fought for the right for women to vote, and all of these things that like America loves to hold up as only possible in America, or things that are uniquely American. If those people aren't then freedom fighters or people that represent the flag, people who represent the ideas that are supposed to be embodied in the flag, if it's only the military, then what are you actually saying about who matters here and what stories matter and who's protected by that flag? What people are saying when they try to invoke that is essentially that the flag is supposed to hold all of us, all of these things, but there's things in there that are diametrically opposed to one another. The flag can't be draped over both the police and the people protesting the police and think that all of that can be American. If that's the case, then American means nothing. The flag stands for absolutely nothing. There are no values, no principles that are being upheld. All you're trying to do is just to uphold the status quo of violence being enacted on people to ensure that they are second-class citizens. And so when people are trying to suss out like what's disrespectful to American symbols, it's to say that they're so tied up with the symbol and what they think or what they have projected onto it, as opposed to dealing with the substance of it.
Let's talk about inequality and capitalism. The subtitle to your book is Life After the American Dream. And so much of what those words American Dream embodies is this idea that anybody can get ahead in America. Today we have massive inequality during the pandemic that has increased even more. Literally, the rich have gotten rich off the pandemic. And yet we have a party in the country that supports capitalism and another party in the country that supports capitalism, if we just talk about the two major parties. How do we get beyond these beliefs and this fundamentalist almost faith in capitalism as the salvation of America when all evidence points to the contrary? Because poverty is a huge part of the problem, but poverty is also the reason why Trump was able to get elected, by showing that, by claiming to be populist, because Democrats didn't do enough about poverty.
Yeah, I do believe that there has been, during the course of our dealing with this pandemic, potential for radicalizing people. And when I say that, I mean introducing them to the failures of capitalism, right? So in the beginning, what was happening, they debated it for a while, but the federal government did eventually send people a check for $1,200, and people are on unemployment were seeing an increase to $600 a week, right? There were so many people for whom that was much better than what they were making at their jobs, right? Like employed full time and yet making below that. And that figure for unemployment was calculated on the idea of minimum wage for 40 hours of work. So if people are making below that, and now they were for a time getting more than that from unemployment, then hopefully what someone is doing in on the ground organizing is pointing that out to folks and saying, well, that just means that you've been underpaid and undervalued for a long time, and that's the way that capitalism works. And I think also there've been potential for different ways of showing alternative models to say, during this time, mutual aid networks have cropped up. And like, it's to say that you're not reliant on a benevolent billionaire. It's your neighbors. It's a community that holds itself up, that supports one another. And also, as you point out, that people have been getting richer. People who are billionaires already are becoming mega billionaires precisely because of a pandemic. And if you can see that, and you can see all of these things clearly, and someone puts those things together for you, I think that there is the potential for a radicalization and people understanding the fault lines of capitalism if it's pointed out to them. The problem, though, is exactly what you allude to, is that the American dream is built on the idea that you can go from nothing to something. That by dint of your own ability, by dint of your own merit, your own intelligence, and your own hard work, you can go from having nothing in this world to being one of those people that have everything, being one of the rich people, being one of the 1% of 1% of 1%. Well, it's not only that is it immoral to want to be in part of a 1% of a 1% that has everything while people have nothing. It's immoral to think that there are people that should have nothing, that they should be in a position in which they have to fight and claw and strive just to make it to a point where they have a decent life. What does that say about how we value life? And I think we have to start thinking of capitalism in a moral context and present it to people in that way, that capitalism is a failure of morality.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
You know, one unique facet that makes Portland so Portland is that we are one of the few cities with a still active community-supported radio station.